You're listening to the Book Talk Today podcast, a podcast that inspires readers to obtain valuable insights to inform, educate, and improve lives. My name is Orn Abdi. I'm an avid reader, best known for the creation of the 1 Minute Book Review community, and I'm sitting down with authors to delve deeper into the books they have written to uncover the story behind the story. Hello everyone and welcome to episode 26 of the Book Talk Today podcast. Today we are joined by Hector Garcia, co-author of the book Ikigai, The Japanese Secret to a Long and Happy Life. We are very excited to have Hector on. We discussed how he became interested in Japanese culture, his journey from Spain to Japan, what it's been like for him living in Japan now for 18 years, and what it means to be an inspiring philosopher about life and different things. We discussed many topics in the podcast, and Hector was also kind enough to accept being on the cover of our next magazine that is coming out later this week as well. So definitely tune into that. But this podcast is full of great insights. We discussed many, many different things, and I'm sure you will find it incredibly inspiring and educational. I hope you enjoy it.
Thank you for having me. It's an honor to be here.
You're welcome. So it's interesting. Over the past year or so, I feel like I've been introduced to Japanese cultures in many different ways. My mum traveled to Japan last year, and it's ever since she's come back, she's always said she just wants to return straight away. And I've had a lot of friends and friends and family that have gone to Japan and loved it. And I've been reading extensively about it. And obviously one of the books that I came across was yours. And I think a great place to start and where I'm interested in finding out is how you were first introduced to Japanese culture and the impact that it had on you.
Well, I think my first memories is when I was born in 1981. So that's in the 80s. I guess in the US there was the internet, but I didn't have the internet or things like that. So my contact with things outside the world was books and comics and TV, and at some point video games. So, and also like technology at home. I always asked, I was very curious always since I was, I think this is a constant in my life, like as a kid. I was always asking, I think my father and my mom, like about the brand in the TV. So this is Sony, and the brand in this machine in the kitchen, which is a microwave, and it's also a Japanese brand. So I started wondering all these machines, that electronic machine, and the calculator I was using was Casio, and my watch was also Casio. And I started having in my mind, okay, all this technology is being made by some people in a place known as Japan. So I thought these people must be very smart. That was my first thought. Like, who are these Japanese people who are like? And I remember looking in an atlas and looking, okay, where is Japan? And it was at the other, I'm from Spain, so it was at the other place, very far away, this little island that they're making all these gadgets and machines that are working in my home here in Spain. I thought that was very mysterious. So that was my first thing, like, okay, it was my first thing, like thinking like, okay, a little bit of admiration for the Japanese people and Japanese culture. And the next one was more like, and I think that sparkled something inside me. I want to be an engineer, a software engineer in the future. I want to also create things and electronics. And the next thing was of course, video games. I had the Super Nintendo, Super Famicom, like Game Boy. And again, it was the same thing. Who is making all these video game machines? Who is making all these video games? Again, it was the Japanese people. And the third one was anime and manga. Dragon Ball was very, I believe Spain was one of the first countries in the world to import Dragon Ball. So we were early Dragon Ball adopters in Spain. I think in other places it arrived later.
Yeah.
And that was the third thing. So those three things
okay.
got me very, like, yeah. And always my mindset was I liked consuming, I liked playing video games. I liked reading manga and anime, but I was always very, I started drawing, trying to draw manga, trying to imitate. And then I started trying to create video games with my computer, programming. So I was trying to imitate them, the Japanese people. So that was my beginnings.
Do you think you're curious about where it came from more than the product itself?
Yes, that's the where the that was my main way of thinking. How are these? Why are these people creating all these things and not us here in Spain? Like, I was wondering.
Yeah,
and I think that's what ultimately brought me to Japan. I came here with an internship for a technology in fact it was a chemical company, a technology laboratory. Now it's, I've been here like, it's gonna be 18 years, so long time ago.
What have you learned being in Japan for that period of time? How have you changed? How have you seen yourself change in that time frame?
That's the master question I make myself always. What have I learned? If not, why are these all these years? Like, I try to, every time, so when I try to answer that question, every time I come up with, I have this tendency lately, I come up with a new book. Like, okay, what have I learned? I have learned many things about their culture. And I think another key question you asked is how it has changed me.
Yeah.
I think it has changed me a lot, but it's very difficult to, this is also, I want to ask you to know yourself is very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
So I always ask my friends when I go back to Spain, how do they feel? And they really feel like I'm a different person from Hector before. But that doesn't mean I'm a better person or worse. I'm just different.
Yeah.
I've become more Japanized. So I think I'm more thoughtful. I speak slower, for example. Yes. And so it has changed me a lot on how I see things.
Okay.
But it's very difficult to know. Like these movies, like you take a time machine. If I could go back 20 years and make a copy of myself and stay in Spain and compare with me now,
yeah,
be very difficult, be very different, but I don't know in which terms.
It would be in like your perspective on life, how has it changed perhaps, that to make a more concrete question, so, how has your perspective on life changed?
One of the things that changed a lot for me, it's, in Europe, when you are living inside a culture, you don't realize all the cultural biases that you have. It's very difficult. It's like the fish. There is this analogy, which is like, if you're a fish that it's always inside the sea and you never look outside, you don't know how it is. So something I realized is that after a while I was in Japan, and then I came back to Europe. One of the things that I started noticing is that the Japanese people see death, the event of dying, in a different, is less of a taboo. And I don't know, and I think this is true not only for Japan, but Asia in general.
Yeah, I think Eastern philosophy sees death very different.
Yeah, so it's less of a taboo, it's more casual. And that was one of the, until I came to, like, I think I've never had conversations about death. And every time there was a death in my family, it was like taboo. You go to the funeral and then it's like, okay. And here in Japan, when there is death. It's not like people are laughing, but it's more like, okay, this is part of life. And it almost looks casual. It's like in Japanese, they have this word atarimae, and it's more integrated into the culture. And I think it has to do also with religions. I'm not saying that Japanese religions are better or worse than in other places, but there is a more in like in Japanese, they are not attached to a religion in concrete. To deal with death, they use Buddhism, like to do funerals. But for example, when you are born, they usually go through the Shintoist ritual. So that was another shock for me. It's like in Spain, I was brought up as supposed, okay, there is one religion. This is what it is. You go to church. That's what it is. Either you have this or not. And in Japan, you have all these, it's not even religions, it's philosophies and beliefs. And each one has different rituals to deal with different phases of your life. And I think that was this very big mind shifter for me. Like, okay, now there is not also here is like a multi belief of multiple gods and beings, and there are many things. Like you can believe whatever you want, and there's not like a dogmatic. And I think that helps to people to see things in a more, I don't know if it makes sense. I think that's one of the things that has changed more my view on life and death.
The relationship between the unseen and the seen, I think, is something that I think Eastern philosophy does very well. In Japan, in particular, they have obviously the relationship between, for instance, the spirits. You know, whether it's spirits in the forest or whether it's spirits in the mountains, there's that connection to the spirit realm or the unseen, which has been lost in Western ways of thinking. It's almost seen as you have a material way of living, you have your materialistic ways of living, which is your body, and after you die, it's just the end, because that's the end of your material way of thinking. But I think what Eastern philosophy does
is like one or zero, right? It's like very divided. And I think that has, even if you, what I say is like, even if you don't believe in that, even if you're an atheist, by being surrounded by that culture, you are kind of behaving in the way that you're supposed to behave. So like death becomes a taboo, and you kind of start believing, not really believing in a conscious way, but in your back on your mind, you are like assuming like life is going to go on forever. So you are making decisions, like the way you are making life decisions is more like, okay, nothing, everything is going to be okay, and we're going to live together forever. And here in Japan, people are making decisions more in like, they think long term, but they're also thinking like in everyday life, to be more like, that's the concept of ichigo, ichie, and also assuming that there is this, because we have earthquakes here and tsunamis, so that's not good, but it also gives you an awareness of, okay, something could happen. I'm talking with you today, but something could happen. And I think this is in the back of the mind of all Japanese people. And people who, like me, who live here in Japan, something could happen tomorrow and bye-bye. So, and that makes you make decisions in different ways in life.
I think the interesting thing that I find about Japanese culture is their relationship with nature. And I think that is something that needs to happen more perhaps in different cultures. And like you said, it's not so much that they believe, it's not the case that you have to believe in a certain way of thinking. It's being in that culture, as you have been for the past 18 years, you might not believe in a religion in the same way, but just by being there, you've adopted the cultural practices, which then changes your mindset, which is very interesting because it doesn't necessarily mean that you've consciously changed your way of thinking. It's just by osmosis and being in there that you've almost changed your outlook on life and your behavior just by being there.
Yes, nature, that's another one that I think I've changed, the relationship with nature and how, and that's something that you notice over a while. Going back to the example of like how, for example, when you build churches in the old times, in European cities, it used to be in the city center. And this is also true, I think, for in the Islam world, you have the city center is where the most sacred. Mm-hmm. In Japan, when you build temples or like Buddhist temples or Japanese shrines, like Shintoist shrines, it's usually somewhere in the outskirts or in the mountains, surrounded by nature. Mm-hmm. It's almost like, for example, Ise Shrine, which is one of the most important shrines in Japan. You go into the shrine and it's very difficult. It's mixed with the forest. You are in the forest and you are going through the gates, and it's like nature is the shrine itself. That you can see it also in the design of houses, architecture in Japan, outside of the cities. Like inside of the cities, Japan has become a little bit very American, I think, lately.
Yeah.
It's becoming, but traditional Japanese houses is like, they're designed to be integrated with nature. You can almost walk and suddenly you're outside and you don't know when you're inside or outside.
Mm. Have you found that with yourself? So you are an amateur photographer, which you say on your website. So did you take up that practice when you were in Japan because you were fascinated by nature?
Oh, photography. That's another thing I got. You see, that I didn't care about photography when I was young. It was when I arrived to Tokyo. But I think the reason is because there are many amazing photographers living in Tokyo. I think some of the top photographers in the world live in, I don't want to compete, but it's, the top ones are probably New York, and then next is Tokyo. So, and I think that's a huge opportunity. I think that got me, I met some of the best photographers in the world and I got very inspired. It was more like not about Japanese culture, but about the kind of, I think this is about the energy of Tokyo City, which it's an amazing city. I think you're in London?
I'm just outside of London, yeah. So okay. I don't live in London.
I think London also has this kind of creative energy,
yeah,
which brings you to have new hobbies. I think London, Tokyo, New York are these kind of cities where like you can, and photography was the one of the first things that I got very obsessed. And also because I think this is like also a cliche, but Japan is very, it depends. Some places in Japan are very, very photogenic. You can take a picture and you are suddenly popular on Instagram. So, I started taking pictures before Instagram.
Can you talk a bit about the energy of Tokyo? Because you mentioned it briefly.
The energy of Tokyo, yes. In fact, that's something I'm going to do a little bit. I always feel I'm going to do a little bit of advertisement. I'm launching a new book this year. Okay. I still don't know the date. It's called The Magic of Japan. It has been published in Spain 3 months ago, and it's going to come up in English for the Olympics. And one chapter, this book is the magic of Japan, which I'm using it as the stand for the country. So I cannot show it. It has lots of pictures that I took myself. And there is, I try to ask myself the question, what does, you asked before, like what I have learned from the Japanese to write this book. I ask myself, what makes Japan so magic and beautiful? And I try to answer that question. And one of the chapters is dedicated only to Tokyo.
Okay.
And I wrote in that chapter 50 points. It was kind of a exercise for me. What are the 50 things of Tokyo that really, I don't know, it has this different energy. And now, as an author, I should remember all these 50 points, but I almost, and now I'm blanking. But about the energy, one of the points is like, there is, that I write is that it's amazing how, so to give you a sense of the scale, I think London is also huge, but Tokyo is kind of like, there is a train line called the Yamanote line, which it moves now with COVID, I don't think so, but in a normal day, in the normal world, it has more passengers in one day than all the train lines and metro lines in New York. So this is only one. So that's only one train line in Tokyo moves more passengers than the whole metro system in New York. So it is kind of amazing, the density of, and yeah, about the creative, I have one of those 50 points is that I can almost, you can almost find, I think I would say almost anything that you want to start a hobby or you have passion for, you will find someone in Tokyo who has that. And I put some weird examples, like I met someone who is the leading expert in the world in making figures of Godzilla. And he had a club to make Godzilla figures. He had a magazine and there was a whole community around him. And he invited me to join. And that could have been one path in my life, but I said no. So that is like, I say that Tokyo is like a city of possibilities and you can choose. And another example is you can become an expert in bonsai cutting. Tons of places you can learn that. Some of the top one, I went to a workshop with one of the most important katana.
Yep.
How to make katanas from scratch.
They're the swords, aren't they?
Yes. So yeah. How to make a sword and anything. So that kind of energy, I think, for a young person, I don't know when I become older, but as a young person, I think it's very, but I don't think it's unique to Tokyo. I think this is similar, set like London, Paris, New York.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's really amazing what you can find in Tokyo. It's like you can find all kinds of things.
What is the energy? Because you've probably been to New York, you've been to London, you've been to Paris. What is unique about the energy in Tokyo as opposed to those other major cities?
The energy
in general.
For example, you go, there is a mysterious, I think cities have this personality. Well, the main thing that I think changes everything is the sense of security. So I can be in a very dark alley, in a very, so whatever I want to Tokyo, in Tokyo at 3 at night alone, I'm going to be okay. It's okay. I can drop my wallet and I can go back like 5 hours later, and it will probably be on the like on the side. Someone has moved it, and then I can take it back. So, and this is a true. I have lots of true story. Like I have a collection of these type of stories.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen, for example, one that comes to mind near my home. One day, going back home, I saw a knife, a brand new iPhone on the floor. So, and it was there, and the next day was there, but moved to the side so people don't step on it. And 1 week later, the iPhone was still there. So that changes everything because you feel secure. And then you find people, for example, sleeping in trains with their backs open because you feel secure that no one is going to steal you. The coffee shops, you have a more relaxed feeling. Also, now that you say about energy, you can go to coffee shops and everything is very silent. If I go to a coffee shop in Spain, it's going to be very, very noisy. So there is a different feeling. And coffee shops here in Tokyo are more like you go to do creative things.
Mm-hmm.
You go, you read books. If you want to talk with a friend in a coffee shop, you usually go to a corner and speak not very loud. So that whole thing creates a different feeling. And then when you go to the big places like Shibuya or Shinjuku, where there's millions of people walking, and I compare it with Times Square.
Mm.
There is much, much more people in Shibuya. But for some reason, people synchronizes. It's like ants. And this is a very weird feeling. You join the stream and somehow it works. And it's very interesting. This is a very famous place to go. You go to a higher place and you take pictures of all the swarms of people moving.
Yeah. Is it the crosswalk?
I don't know if that answers your question about the energy, but
it does. It's interesting.
It's very difficult to explain, but you definitely feel it when you land in Tokyo and you spend 3-4 days here. And then a good experiment, maybe you can ask your mom, when she came back home, you feel something like, oh, wow, I'm back to normal.
She misses it because she was.
It's a very weird feeling. Yeah. Like you feel something like here that I think it cannot be explained in words. It's not like it's better or worse, but it's a totally different feeling that you will not get in any other country because the rest of Asia is kind of different. The feeling that you feel here is very different.
Yeah, she was staying near Fujisan. So, and there's a lake there. I forget the name of the lake.
But Yamanakako, probably.
Yeah, I think that was the one. And she said that there was a very different feeling there. And the feeling in the air and the spirit of the people, as well as the environment, I think she misses that feeling. And I think she struggles to put it into words in the same way that you do. And obviously you've been there for 18 years and she was only there for, I don't know, 2-3 months. I think she was staying there. So.
It's very difficult. That's why I take many pictures. That's what I tried with this new book. I tried to create a feeling because now people cannot travel. So I try to bring the reader to Japan through my words and my pictures. So you start feeling like you are traveling with me in Japan.
You talk about Japanese philosophy in there because I feel like obviously in the book Ikigai you talk about Japanese philosophy and the relationship between Japanese philosophy and living a meaningful life. So how's your exploration of Japanese philosophy progressed over the 18 years of living there, and do you think it's a combination of reading about it and living it?
I think it's a combination of living it, and I would say in Ikigai, we wrote about Ikigai in Japanese means the purpose of life, or the purpose, it literally means life worthwhile. So something, things that make your life worthwhile. That's Ikigai. And in fact, in Ikigai, we mix, it's people think it's, we wrote, it is the first book about this concept. It's not like the Japanese had a philosophy of Ikigai. It's like we created a philosophy of Ikigai. By, it sounds a little bit like by mixing different ideas. I wrote it, I was going through a hard time in my life, and I wrote it to help myself. So that's how everything started. And I was reading lots of existentialist philosophers from the 60s and 70s, like French philosophers, Albert, I'm looking now at my Camus? Albert Camus. Yes. So, and I found out that no one had written in a nice way what all this existentialism is, or what logotherapy is. Like there's very good books like by Viktor Frankl, but you don't have a, like a book that puts everything together. And these books are starting to be a little bit obscure because it's like language from 50, 60 years ago.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's Ikigai is like, in a way, is like existentialism big mixed with Japanese thinking. And revived and repopularized, like popularizers of, and I think that's why it connects with so many people. So, because we are not giving you a concrete recipe, this is, we are not telling you this is how you should live life, or this is like the dogmatic way of doing things. This is very Japanese. Japanese don't tell you like, this is only one way. They give you like, it has traditions and things to follow, but then you have to forge your way. And that's what we write with Ikigai, is like we can, the main tenet is like also of existentialism, you can believe whatever you want. You can believe in one God, many gods, no gods. You can believe in the afterlives. You can be in any religion or whatever you want. But we can all agree that we are now, you and me, we are alive and talking here. We can agree on that. That's probably true. And we were born at some point, right, in the past. And in the future, we will probably die, right? So we have this time here in planet Earth, and we can all agree what happens after and before. Maybe we can disagree, and it's like we've been discussing this for thousands of years. But while we are alive, we can agree that we should aim to lead a good life, right? And there might be unfortunate events and good events. It will depend. We will have ups and downs. And through all our life, we should aim to have the most purpose as possible. And that's where the idea of Ikigai is, like you have to lead a life of purpose to make the best of your time here. So that's very ingrained in Japanese culture. That's kind of, again, they use the word, they don't have a philosophy per se, but they live in this way. They live in a daily, okay, this is what is worthwhile doing today. This is my Ikigai. Sometimes they take it too far, they work too much, but we try to take only the positive.
One of the questions that I gave to the followers to ask you, because I opened up sort of like a Q&A, one of the concerns that a lot of people have, especially after reading your book, and it's not a negative concern, it's a lot of people find it hard to differentiate between what's passion and what's purpose. And I would like to know from your experience reading, like you said, existentialist philosophy, but also the understanding of Japanese philosophy as well, what the difference of passion and purpose is, because I have my own way of defining it, but I'd be really interested to find what your definition between passion and purpose is.
Okay, yeah, that's a very good question. At the end, I also believe that words and language can confuse us a lot.
Yes, definitely. So
for some people, it might be, you might think, okay, this is, it's the same or not. But I see, this is how I see it for my, like, I can feel very passionate about something, or, and it can be something very concrete. I'm very passionate about eating chocolate like every afternoon, and I spend 2-3 months very obsessed with this brand of chocolate, and I'm talking and recommending to all my friends, oh my God, this chocolate is amazing. Or it can be you start finding that you love and you're passionate about wine. And then, I don't know, you're very passionate for 2-3 months about a new Netflix series.
Mm.
And then suddenly you're very passionate with, you have a new love for it. You love this actor or this actress. Mm. So these are all these, and that's good. Like, you're passionate and you feel energized with all these things. But you see where I'm going? That's not, you cannot make a life eating chocolate. Does it make sense? That's not your purpose of things. There might be, so, but all these passions, I think you have to be, these are hints.
Mm.
I think you should be very, like, you should see, like, there might be a pattern in all these passions. Like, you might notice that all your passions have something to do, are very, for example, I'm going to make an example. You're very passionate about reading. You're very passionate about, you like, all the activities that you like are alone. So then your purpose in life, or something that you build purpose, should be something that allows you to be happy with that. So you shouldn't get into become a car salesman, for example. But if all your passions are related to being, you love hanging out with your friends, you're a social person, you love dancing, for example, you're very passionate about dancing. So maybe you should consider, like, maybe you will try, you will have purpose in a career in sales, and you will be filled with purpose while becoming a very good salesman.
Mm.
Does it make sense? So
going back to what you said at the beginning about how you're intellectually curious. So the way that
that's where it goes to. That's the purpose. That's when you start layering down, you start seeing exactly. That's, you start seeing, okay, like that's starting to be a more purpose-driven thing. Like, I'm a curious person who likes to analyze and think things through and learn, and then put everything together into writing and share it with other people. So hopefully I help them to lead better lives. That would be my purpose or my ikigai. And that's like, it connects. See how I explained my whole purpose or ikigai is kind of not only, it's a little bit egoistic at the beginning. It's for myself. It makes me feel good, like curiosity and learning and everything. But in the end, I'm sharing it with the world too. So
like, I think it has to derive from the self to start off with. Otherwise, there's no motivation to do it. Because everything can't be, I don't think anything is truly altruistic at the beginning. It's maybe a byproduct of what you're doing.
Yes, I think that's that might be some people might think differently, but I think I agree with you. Even people who famously, yeah, they are very, very like they donate, they do it because it feels good to them. So yeah, I agree with you.
Or they get a library named after them.
Yeah. Yes.
So yeah, no, it's just an interesting thing for me to think about, because like the way that I see it is very similar to you. So everything that I do is through the lens of intellectual curiosity, whether it's learning a new skill, whether it's reading a certain type of book, whether it's like doing this podcast, whether it's creating content, it's all around the purpose, my purpose of intellectual curiosity, or learning and developing myself and also sharing that with others. And like, for instance, I had a message from someone who said, I did a like a video clip, whatever. And I talked about how we shouldn't be passionate. And I got this message from this girl, and she's being a doctor. And she's like, I'm studying to be a doctor because I'm passionate about it. And I replied to her, I'm like, the reason why you're going through 6 years of study is not because you're passionate about it, it's because you find purpose in becoming a doctor and what being a doctor means. Because passion, like you said, doesn't last for 6 years through study. It's something that is somewhat fleeting.
Yes, I see passion. So like, in fact, that's the main, that's probably the right meaning of the words from the ancients, passion. I forgot now, maybe with someone in the ancient Greek or in philosophy, is like passions are these things that happen to not, I think it happens to human beings, like, okay, this passion that drives you. But yes, something that can sustain your interest for 10, 20 years, it's more like purposeful. It has to be. So that's another thing to identify. If you lose interest in something after 6 months, then maybe that was just some like thing that you have to watch it. Like, okay, this
thing. Yeah, you definitely. And that goes back to the quote that you talk about in the book. And it's a famous quote by, I think it's Nietzsche, that says, someone who has a why can bear any how. And it's one of those things where I think purpose falls into that category in relation to that quote.
If not, you just run away, which is also okay sometimes. But that's another question that I get asked a lot. Where is the fine line to give up on something that you've been, or keep doing it? And that's a question that I don't have a definitive answer. I can only say that one valid answer is that most humans, most of the times we give up too early. Most of the success stories that I've seen is like, okay, this person has been drawing for 20 years and now he's one of the best drawers, blah, blah, blah. This person, so that it's usually people who kept doing something. But probably they gave up on many other things. So now, so that's where the difficulty comes. Like, what do you choose from? And that's also important, because if you try to do five things at the same time, then you have to make decisions there, where to focus. And to give you an example of myself, I see you also have camera there with photography.
Yeah.
So for a while, I was very, very obsessed with photography. And I even started, I had some gigs in Tokyo where I made some money, like taking photos, and I thought, okay, maybe I would love to dedicate myself to photography. But I decided to stop it. So I totally stopped that path. But I didn't eliminate to zero, I kept it as a very casual hobby. So I still take pictures, but I don't spend 5-6 hours on Saturdays with Lightroom and Photoshop and selecting the raw files and printing the images to try to do an exposition in Tokyo. I don't go because I wanted to allocate more time to my writing. So it was a conscious decision. Okay, I have to reduce photography. It was a hard decision. I felt very weird inside me. Like, okay. And yes, so that's my personal, but yeah, I don't know.
When you were making that transition, something I think about a lot is, as someone who is quite creative myself, I always struggle with prioritizing ideas and prioritizing the things that I'm doing at any moment. And I'm sure you feel the same way. Do you feel like there is something that is a conscious thought, or do you almost feel like sometimes you have to let it play out and see which thing takes priority? Do you make a conscious effort to choose different things, like you said, with the photography and the writing, or sometimes do you just now, let it play out?
Now, yes. Now I make a conscious effort and I make sure. 10 years ago when I was 30, and I think I was a little bit more, I still had my hormones. And in my 20s, I went crazy. Like all my feelings, whatever I felt like, there was no, and I think that's okay too. It's like, whatever I felt like, it's like, whoa, okay. And I had also energy to do all things. But I think now I make a very conscious like decision of what is the main thing for me. It's writing. So I make a very conscious decision that every day I'm writing. And I have that time for that. And then after that, I can keep writing. And I'm not a robot at the end of the day. After that, after the writing is done, I can also go crazy and do something else. I can, okay, I'm going to go 3 hours and go for a walk in a shrine and start taking pictures. Or like last 2 weeks, which we had beautiful sakura blossom. I've taken lots of pictures. I've spent, and it was amazing. So, but I make the conscious decision that, okay, every day. And I plan this the first hour in the first in the morning. My first 2 hours is writing. And that's a very, and 5-10 years ago, I didn't have that. It could be like 2-3 weeks without writing, and then 2-3 weeks writing, and then I would be taking pictures, and then I would be programming my whatever I was programming, like my pet projects. So I was all over the place. And I think that's okay too, depending on the moment on your life and how creative you're feeling. And also if you're starting to find synergies between different activities. For example, I find very common between writers that they love playing the piano or music.
Yeah.
Because while they're playing music, there's something else in the brains, and then it's going to come up as better writing. For me, I think it's the photography. Like photography, and then I change, and then I write, and then there's this shift and this balance.
Yeah.
But you have to fine-tune to yourself, like see what...
I'm reading this book at the moment. It's called Daily Rituals by Mason Curry, and it talks about famous artists and creatives and what their routines were like. And it seems like every artist had their own, every writer had their own routine, and something consistent was walking and taking the time to walk and empty the mind.
Yes, walking, I think it's a common... I walk every day, especially these days that I need to walk. And something mysterious for me is that while walking, I'm not really having ideas. It's after the walking that they come up. I think a good combo is walking and then take a shower. And then okay. In the shower, they're like...
okay, does that like everything happens?
Yes, but these routine books are interesting, but something... So that, then you find out that everyone is crazy. Like some people do their things at night and morning.
Yeah.
So you have to find what works for you.
What's for you? Yeah, it's so important.
There is one common thing between all of them. They have allocated certain time to do what they have to do.
Exactly. That's so true. That's so true.
It sounds super, super simple, but yeah. It's like, what is the secret? It's like, okay, every day you have this, and then the rest of the day you can go. It's okay.
It's so true, because what's happening at the moment is there's people saying that you have to wake up at this time, you have to do this after this time, you can't eat after 10 p.m. because you have to sleep by 10 p.m. And then you look at these artists and creatives, and they're like, some of them work from 10 p.m. to 4 p.m. in the morning and then sleep until 12 p.m. and then and you think to yourself, well, kind of just throws everything out the window.
That makes me even more stressed. That doesn't work for me. If I do that, it feels like work. It feels like you're working in a factory.
You're a robot.
Yes, you're like, okay, if I have to do this at this time, I will go to sleep when I'm tired. I will wake up when I feel like waking up. And things like. One example that comes to, I was reading a biography about Yukio Mishima, which is a Japanese novelist from last century. And he in 25 years, he wrote 50 books, I think, 20 something novels. So it was around 2 books per year, okay?
That's some productivity.
So that's some craziness. And he had no internet, and he wrote all the books with a pen.
With a hand. Love that.
With his hand in paper with Japanese characters. And his routine, like it, at some point in the biography, it's written, he wrote every night from 12 at night until sunrise. So while his family was sleeping, and then he would sleep all morning, and he would wake up at around 12 or 1 in the afternoon. He would have a cup of coffee, and then he would do normal day. He liked practicing kendo with, he lived in Tokyo. So that's like, he went to the dojo to practice kendo, and then he would go to the swimming pool. And he would have a social dinner every day. He liked party, but he would always finish the party. He was the type of person who left the party around 11, half past 11 at night, and he didn't drink alcohol. So he went home and started writing. So every time he was invited to a party, he would leave the party. And he was an important person. He was invited. He was friends with the mayor of Tokyo. And he was a very important person in Tokyo. And during the day, he had like an important person type of life. And at night, he was like, okay, I'm going to write. And I could never do that. At night, I need to sleep. But he somehow that worked for him. So maybe it works for you. I don't know.
It doesn't work for me. I'm very much like you. Okay. I need my sleep. But
maybe who is reading is like, oh, I have some friends who get this amazing energy at 11 or 12 at night. But for me it's the reverse. I have the energy at
in the morning.
Yeah, in the morning.
So what is your routine?
So for me, mine is like these days. So weirdly now, I wake up very, I don't know if this happened to you, or I used to wake up around 7, half past 7. But now, because of COVID, maybe, I don't know, I'm waking up at 5:30. 6. And then I write for 2-3 hours until I run out of ideas. So that's my morning routine, basically. And then I try to, after writing, I try to do exercise daily. I do exercise, how do you call it? Calisthenics, very yes. simple. I do body weight exercises until I do it in a very nearby park. So I try to get some sunlight, do exercise outdoors, because yeah, I don't know how gyms are. Yeah, like gyms in Tokyo are not opening at these days. And then yeah, that's basically, and the rest of the day is like I go with the flow, whatever it comes, like talk with you now, for example.
Mm.
And read. I like the end of the day, I like a lot reading, like for 1-2 hours.
Mm.
Because that will create, for some reason, that will clean up my mind to sleep well.
Mm.
And then when I wake up, I will have my ideas because of the reading. And I try to mix the first, if I read for 1-2 hours, I read first nonfiction. And when I start being tired of nonfiction, I change to fiction. And then that frees me, because nonfiction is more like I get engaged like with the ideas.
Mm.
And funny, yesterday I started reading 7 years in the Tibet.
Okay.
It's a book that I should have read, but for some reason I've never read. And if someone has not read it, I started reading and I couldn't stop. It's kind of fascinating.
What is it about? I haven't heard of it.
Okay, then you have to. This is to your
reading list.
Seven years in Tibet.
Okay, I'll add it to the list.
I will not spoil. You will see. It's fast. It's a real story. So it's not. It's not. But it reads like a novel, because it's so. At least the first chapters, I was like, oh wow, this guy went through something incredible. It's almost like a novel, but it's a true story.
It's a movie with Brad Pitt as well, apparently.
Yes. So don't watch the movie. the movie is very good. But okay. I almost forgot. I forgot the movie. So I said, I'm going to read the book. Because okay. I forgot them. I watched the movie like 15 years ago. So yes, it's like 7 years in Tibet. I think they read the book first and then watch the movie.
Okay, cool. I'll do that. Thanks for that recommendation. One thing I do want to talk about, and you touched on it briefly, was something that I've been doing and something that I've been talking about with other authors, is writing drafts or writing by hand, and the difference between writing by hand and typing. Something that I came across was the fact that you can type quicker than you can think sometimes. And Neil Gaiman, the famous fiction author, does all his first drafts by hand with fountain pens. And one thing I wanted to talk about with you is
I bought the same fountain
love
pen. Yes. This is the Neil Gaiman recommendation.
Is it?
Yes.
I love this.
But this is another thing. If you buy it, you will not become as Neil Gaiman. This is another thing that people don't. But even though I'm conscious of it, like, it inspires me. Like,
yes, definitely.
You feel it's like photography. If you buy the same camera as the best photographer in the world, it doesn't mean that you will become the best. You have to be very. You have to put the hours.
So yes,
that's very important.
So have you been inspired then to write by hand, and what's your process for writing?
So yes, I've learned many things by doing it. You start realizing it depends on the stage. So for example, to be very concrete, if I have to write a conversation between two characters, in a fiction type of way. Like, it's much better to write it, I think, with a keyboard, because it feels more natural. If you write with your pen, you will write more slowly. I think it's better for if I have to describe a Japanese temple or a landscape, I will write a better description if I take my notebook and start writing the words slowly. It will help my brain. And then I write that down to the computer. It will be a much more beautiful. I don't know why, but it works. I'm telling you. But if you write everything with your pen, it will be too much. And then you will have to, maybe that works for you, you will have to cut a lot of garbage. Talking about the process, for me, one of the key things is to have learned to, probably I learned that with my co-author in Ikigai, who is a very good editor. The Ikigai, the book, should have been like 2 times the size it is. And Frances was cutting everything. He was like, and at the beginning I felt a little bit, my ego, why are you deleting this? This is good. But he was right. It's like a diamond that you have to cut down.
Yep.
Cut down. And I think the greatest writers in the world are very good at reducing all the words that are not needed to. So by writing in paper, you write many words that are not needed. But that's also good to maybe, you will bring up from your subconscious maybe some descriptions that were hidden there, that if you type, it will never come up. I think that's the, so I mix everything to have, like, when I feel like, okay, I need this description, I will. And to take notes, I also take notes in notebooks for nonfiction. And then I'm very chaotic with my real process of, I'm very chaotic. I start writing one chapter, but then I have ideas on another, and I start somewhere else. And then maybe I get into something for 2 weeks, I'm very obsessed, and then I forget about it 6 months, and then I come back and I start mixing with something else. And after 5-6 months, I start having like a cloud, like a document of 100 pages that is a mess, but starts being like a book. And then is when I start writing the, like a plot or like an index, which there is a different type. Some people are totally, is the different type of writer that writes the whole index at the beginning and then you write, which is more organized. That doesn't work for me, because again, I think it feels, that would feel like work for me.
Yeah.
And I don't like, I'm very rebel in that aspect. If I spend 3 days writing an index and plotting and have 5 pages, then I feel like, okay, everything is decided and I just have to write the book for the next 6 months. It feels like work. So I'm very chaotic in that sense. Only when I have enough chaos, I say, okay, I have to put order. And then it goes some months of cleaning up and finishing the whole thing.
Do you think it's important to give yourself time for your subconscious to work through the ideas whilst you, because a lot of the time I feel like with my writing or my ideas, the best ideas happen when I don't look at it for, let's say, an extended period of time, because.
Yes, definitely.
Do you think it's important to consciously think about not doing anything for an extended period of time?
Working on something else.
Something else, yeah.
I have other, I'm writing now many books at the same time. And some things will go to the back of my mind, like in a natural way, as you say. And yeah, I need time. But I know some other writers who don't need to, they can just do it, which is amazing. But for me, I'm like you. I need time for my subconscious, and also not only my subconscious, but to start gathering. Once you start thinking about something, you will start noticing things in other people's conversations and things like that. So, for example, today you said to me, "What have you learned from the Japanese people?" Now this question might stay in my mind the next days, and then I might, when I'm having a conversation with a Japanese person, I will notice something like, okay, and then I will remember, oh, I remember Abdi asked me this in the interview. This Japanese person is answering me in a way which is like showing perseverance. Maybe perseverance is something that I've learned from the Japanese. And then I start having, okay, everything is not only about subconscious, but is you start having a sensor on that.
Mm.
So, and then you start having, now, for example, we brought up the Tibet book. If you start reading that, then you start having a sensor. If so, maybe you were not interested in, then you start finding Tibet pictures on Instagram, and then you start reading, and then you start having all this landscape of new ideas. It's like start appearing a new world in your mind.
Mm-hmm. I find that, especially when you give yourself time and you think through ideas, is, for instance, it allows you to then bring in new ideas to the thing that you're doing. And everything that you consume, everything that you read, broadens that picture, and it broadens that area that then adds to that story or adds to that idea that you've originally thought of. So it's not so much, someone might look at it from the outside and being like, you're procrastinating on the idea, but you know that yeah, is adding to the value of it.
No, that's, if you read like scientists' biographies, it's always like that. They're like 2, 3, 4 years obsessed with something, and then they forget about it in a closet, and then they go for a walk to the forest, and when they go back, they have a Eureka moment. It's like
it's something that I think about, because like a couple of years ago I wrote like in a state of, let's call it passion, in like 4 days I wrote like 20,000 words of like a story plot. It's like a historical fiction book, and I haven't looked at it for like 3-4 years. And I had a conversation with an author, and we were talking about historical fiction, and he was talking about
where is it set.
1453, the siege of Constantinople.
1453, wow. Okay.
Yeah, so it's based on the siege of Constantinople, which is now Istanbul. Because I'm fascinated by Ottoman history. That's like my favorite period of history. And and I've completely forgotten that I'd written this piece. And it was only through the conversation that I had with him, I'm like, wait, I've written something. So then I found it, and then I reread it, and then I thought, this is something that I need to do. And it's what we talked about earlier, in the fact that if you haven't seen anything for 3-4 years and you still have the idea and you've still been working on it, it's probably something that you should pursue.
Yeah, maybe now if you start playing with those 20,000, it will become 40,000, and you have a novel there.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's like it's an interesting concept to me, artistic creativity, and where that comes from. Do you have a thought on that?
No, just the same. I also have this. Also, you will get, you're a different, going back to what you said, like you're a different person. You said you wrote those 20,000 words, how many years ago?
Three, four years ago.
So now when you read that, you will start noticing, you will want to change things.
Oh, yes.
Because you are a different person now. You will start noticing things, but it will also bring you back to this. There will be things that you will want to change, and some others that you will say, I want to live like it is, because this was how I was on that time. So that change of, and one of the, if you publish the book, you will not have a chance to change it. So then it's interesting to go back. Now, when I go back to my first book, which is titled A Geek in Japan, which I wrote 2006, something like that, I'm very childish in my writing. I'm very excited. I'm like, whoa, this is amazing. Japan is, this is amazing. And I feel I would, now if I would change everything, but I should not. That's how I was in that moment.
Yeah.
And that's okay. It has a vibe. That was Hector when I this is a Japanese thing. You talk about yourself in third person.
Third person.
So this is Hector when it was 26 years old or 25 years old. And that's okay. That was me. And now I would write something else. And so that's also interesting to read when you read all the novels or books from a historical author. I like analyzing the difference between especially the first books and the last books.
Yeah.
And you can see that also in painters. If you look at Picasso, which is a very typical example, if you see early paintings of Picasso and late paintings of Picasso, it's like
you can see the transformation.
What has happened with this?
Yeah.
Like inside him is a different, but probably he was okay with those. Like, okay, that was what it was.
Do you think it's important to refer to yourself in the third person in that sense, from a creativity point of view?
I don't know. I think it's okay. It's weird. I don't know.
Because do you think it's interesting?
I was thinking like it's almost like, I don't know if I identify. It was obviously me. It was obviously myself 15 years ago who was writing. But it was a different, I was totally, I don't know. I saw the world in a different way probably.
Because the way that I see it is when you refer to yourself in the third person, whether it's in the present or whether it's in the past, you take the ego out of it.
Okay, that's another conversation, the ego. that the way I saw, so changing a little bit, this like going back to the process of writing, it's so bad, like taking out your ego outside of your writing is very important. Sometimes you subconsciously you forget your writing. You have to always think that you're writing not for yourself, but you're writing for your readers. So that's a very important thing that I keep in mind. For your ego, you can write your diary, which that's also, that helps a lot. Also, like, it's a very good practice, but when you're writing for others, it's not your diary, and you don't have to show how intelligent you are in your writing. You have to make things clear and beautiful and inspire people.
Yeah, it's not about you. Perfect. We've discussed many things, Hector, on this podcast. I've thoroughly enjoyed it.
These are the kinds of subjects I love.
Well, I look forward to having you back on to discuss your new book.
Yes, I think we can keep talking about, we could keep talking for a long time.
Yeah, we could. We definitely can. We definitely can.
Japan.
When's that new book coming out then?
I don't. I have to. To tell you the truth, I'm a little bit disaster with this. I don't know. I think for the Japan Olympics. It's printing now, the book. So I think it should be, when it's printing, it should be 2-3 months from now.
Okay. It'd be good to have you to come back on to talk about that one, because I know Ikigai's been out for quite a while.
And I think it will be in the UK. Yeah, it will be distributed in the UK. And if you like, we should get a copy. Your mom would love the book.
Yes, I'm sure she will. I'm sure she will. She suggested that I read this one, that your Ikigai book. So
okay.
She can you can thank her for that. She had it, and I saw it, and then I was like, okay, I should probably read this. And then I read it, and I thought, well, let's reach out to the author. And then I reached out to you, and you were very kind to accept this offer. And I there were still many things that I obviously wanted to discuss with you, mainly talking about philosophy and ideas, but I think we'll save that for another day.
Okay, next time.
Next time. Anyway, Hector, thank you so much. Where's the best place where people can find you on social or on your website?
I think these days there is no best place. I'm all over the place.
Tell me about it.
I'm on Instagram, Twitter. But yeah, I put everything together now. I have a website called hectorgarcia.org.
Okay.
And that's the main place. And I think on Twitter, you can also find me hectorgarcia.org. I think that's those are the main ones. And on Instagram, if you look for Ikigai book, there is... I'm on Instagram uploading pictures.
Reposts. Of
Sakura and reposts. I'm very lazy on Instagram. I cannot spend. See, that's going back to a conscious decision. I try to spend as less possible time on Instagram as possible.
So, yeah, I try and do the same.
So I do reposting very fast.
One of the things that I get asked all the time is because I always talk about like managing your time and time blocking, all those kind of things. And one of the things
I checked your Instagram, which kind of like you're very process. Correct me if I'm wrong. If I remember well, your Instagram is very. It feels like you have a whole process that you're very. To manage your
structured.
Instagram. Yes, which it looks good. The end result.
Yeah, that's my mind. Like if we're talking about my mind being transferred into
Instagram
or into anything that I do, it's very structured in the way. Otherwise, I wouldn't. I'm like when you were talking about writing in chaos, I couldn't live with that level of chaos because I can't function in that environment. I need to be order.
Just one step by step.
Yeah, but in the same way that I still wouldn't write out contents before I started writing because that doesn't give me creative freedom. That inhibits my creative freedom. So you're sort of balancing the two, if that makes sense.
Okay. Maybe what works for you, you're going to start having... You start with a blank page and you write about one idea. And then you store it somewhere.
That's usually what I do.
You have another idea and you write down and then you store it.
Yeah, I mean, I pretty much have a notebook dedicated to just writing down like just not ideas, but like written down ideas like by hand. Okay. So like if I have an idea and I want to sort of write a couple of pages on it, I just write it down and then see if there's actually any weight to it. Because sometimes, like you probably have this, you have an idea and you think, oh, there might be something in that. But then when you start writing it, it gets boring. Yeah, exactly. It gets boring after half the page and you're like, well, I'm glad I didn't spend any more time on that. So it's almost like a litmus test, isn't it? To find out whether it's actually a good idea or not.
Yeah, that's a very good test. Like also going back to before, that's the ultimate test. If something is boring to you, it will be boring for the readers too.
Yeah.
So you can keep it in your diary. That's yeah, okay.
I'll keep it in the diary. No one can read that. No one wants to read that. Anyway, Hector, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for taking the time. Thank and I look forward to having you on again soon to talk about the next book.
Thank you.
Thank you. Take care. Bye.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. Don't forget to like, share, and subscribe for more content. Also, visit our website, www.booktalktoday.com, to subscribe and download the latest edition of our magazine. Join our mailing list to receive the first issue for free to get a taste for the value-packed content that we are offering. Book Talk Today, for readers, by readers.